Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
I saw the newspaper, which in my case where I lived, the Virginian Pilot out of Norfolk, and I saw the datelines, and I loved the datelines, and I thought they watch sports, and they have these datelines, so they bounce around and travel, and I think it was the datelines that grabbed me.
That's Chuck Culpepper. Chuck and I were friends for years before I ever met him. We used to talk about music and storytelling in a chat room created by some fellow writers back in the internet's dial-up days. Chuck is one of the few openly gay male sports writers in America. He's also a real-life version of that George Clooney character in Up in the Air. He roams the world so voraciously that he went years without an official address. What has he seen on all those travels? And what has kept him moving for so long? That's what we're about to find out. Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. These days, Chuck Culpepper writes about sports for the Washington Post. He was in Charlotte last week for the ACC men's basketball tournament. Here's what he wrote about Duke star Zion Williamson's performance in the tournament. Quote, "The event gave a sort of demonstration of basketball evolution, how in the year 2019, humanity can fashion a 285-pound man who moves like an optical illusion." Nobody else writes like Chuck Culpepper. Here's our conversation. Chuck Culpepper, I normally don't ask people to do this, but because I think in your case it's interesting, can you just kind of give us your resume, tell us sort of where you've lived and worked in your sports writing life?
Okay. Age 14, Little League weekly wrap-up for the Suffolk Sun weekly edition of the Virginian Pilot.
So we're going way
Suffolk,
back
Virginia,
now.
Yeah. The Cavalier Daily in college at University of Virginia. The Suffolk News Herald, the newspaper in my hometown. The Los Angeles Herald Examiner in Los Angeles. The National Sports Daily in Chicago. The National Sports Daily in Pittsburgh. They moved me to Pittsburgh. The Lexington Herald Leader in Kentucky. The Oregonian in Portland. Newsday in New York. Then London and Paris on a contract with the Los Angeles Times for 3.5 years. The National, another thing called the National, a newspaper in Abu Dhabi.
A different national.
A different national.
In a different nation.
In a different nation. But the third, there are only three nations called with that start with United. So I had to complete the, you know, States, Kingdom, Arab Emirates. So I did it. No, but Sports on Earth, USA/USA Today, and then Washington Post.
The thing that jumps out at me is Abu Dhabi. I remember, I don't remember if this was in that phase of your life or what, but I remember reading, somebody asked you like what your greatest sports experience was, and you talked about getting basically thrown off the back of a sailboat.
Right.
Was that in Abu Dhabi or is that a different?
Abu Dhabi spawned that, and that was an incredible experience. The Volvo Ocean Race, which goes around the world, it's usually every 3 years, takes 9 months to do, and the stops were, let's see, first one in Spain on the Mediterranean, second one Cape Town, then Abu Dhabi, Sanya, the island in China, Auckland, New Zealand, Itajaí, Brazil, which I could spell it, but I never could say it, Miami, Lisbon, a stop in France, and then Ireland, where it finished that year. At each stop along that way, they have an import race, which is counts for some of the points in the entire race, where they just race each other inside the port where fans can look from the shore and kind of see it. You know, it's a hard sport to follow.
Right. And then it's not a great spectator sport.
No, no. And then as they head off to sea and they're wished well by the crowds and so on, they usually have a celebrity on the back of the boat who jumps off as you're going. But it's sort of part of the whole experience. So the person jumps off the back and then the boat heads on out. And so then in Cape Town, they didn't have any celebrities, so they said, why don't you just write about it and you do this? So I remember all the sailors were telling me about there's a lot of sharks in the water. And when you're in the hotels there, all the brochures have these angry-looking sharks on them because you can go on a shark tour, you know. And so all the sailors were kidding me about it. And then you have one of those life-preserving elements where it activates by hitting the water. But maybe that wouldn't work.
Oh, great.
You know, maybe that kidding me about that. And then a rib, which is a rigid inflatable boat. I can't believe I even learned any of these things. comes in behind you and picks you up. So I stepped off the back, you know, of this gorgeous, I think 70 foot, as I recall, into the water. And I could see Table Mountain, you know, which is stunning. I could see it from the, I was thinking, this is so, I grew up in Suffolk, Virginia. This is just completely out of anything I ever would have imagined before. And so then I think I was in the water 20 seconds. And they pick you up, haul you, and they take a photo. And then I wrote a column about it. So I haven't thought about that in a long time.
And you mentioned that kind of what led into what I was going to ask next. That's quite a ways from Suffolk, Virginia. Right. And I guess I wanted to kind of get an idea of what your life was like there as you were growing up. And did you imagine any of these things, the sports part about it, the travel part about it, any of that stuff when you were younger?
I think I always wanted to travel to Europe. I was sure I wanted to travel to Europe. Just at that time, you know, I don't think I really ever thought of Asia, which I adore. I would love to live in Hong Kong or Bangkok. You know, if I could ever figure out how. I don't think I ever really thought about Australia. Australia was not mingled with the world quite as much as it is now, and except if you went to a tennis tournament, maybe. And in fact, the Sydney Olympics was always seen there as a big, you know, a big, wow, they know us now, they love us, you know, that kind of moment. Right. And I don't think I thought about Africa, which I've been, you know, which I've had some of the most meaningful experiences, you know, there. So I think, I don't think I thought much about South America, which has a few really stunning cities. And, you know, Buenos Aires is just a gem, as everyone says. And, you know, you think, one morning I was walking in Buenos Aires at 9 a.m. This was on a vacation. But there were so many people out walking to work. And I was just thinking, all these people walk to work all these years here. And growing up in Virginia, I never once thought about them. And there's thousands here on this street and millions in the city.
Right, right. And where did the sports part come in? Was that something that when you were a kid you were always interested in right away? Or
I wanted to be a sports writer when I was about 8 or 9.
Why? And
I saw the newspaper, which in my case where I lived, the Virginian Pilot out of Norfolk, and I saw the datelines. And I loved the datelines. And I thought, they watch sports. I hadn't really ever thought about the writing of it, which is now my favorite challenge, you know, of it. But they watch sports and they have these datelines. So they bounce around and travel. And, you know, that was the days when a newspaper of that size would send its columnist to Pasadena for the Super Bowl. I remember that. Mm-hmm. Two writers to Pasadena for the Super Bowl 14 they did in 1980. There was a student newspaper interview with me when I was in fifth grade, and that's what I said I wanted to do, either broadcast or write. And then you know how kids always, they want to be a veterinarian or whatever, you know, they want to be a fireman or something like that. And then that's not ultimately what it was, but I just followed it all the way through. So I wonder, should I have tried, maybe I should try to do something else in life, you know? But it has enough variety, and I think sports is such a window on the world, maybe the very best one.
Well, talk about that a little bit. What has drawn you to it, and what that windows on the world thing, what, explain that a little bit.
That's the thing that's really taken hold for me, say, over recent years especially, you know, that I didn't think about so much in the beginning. In the beginning, it was going to the games and having a terrific seat and feeling privileged to go to the games, feeling lucky. Still feel lucky, but well, say last year I was in Liverpool and to do a story on Mo Salah, the striker who had all those goals for Liverpool last year, all of a sudden Egyptian. So I went around Liverpool and I went to a mosque and these two men were standing outside and they said, I told them why I was there, and they just said, please come. They put me in the car, tour of the entire city, around and around, explained to me different places, different neighborhoods. And they said to me something that was so striking. They said their personal relationships and friendships had changed and tightened between Muslims and Christians or other religions, you know, because of him. It seemed to lend some sort of fresh layer to the bond of the friendships. You know, people they regularly knew, but they felt closer to them now. Wow. I mean, I guess sports might be the only thing that can pull off such a thing like that. In another area, I just did a story in December on a high school team in Kentucky that I watched play in a state final 25 years in 1993. And I wanted to check on the 42-year-old men because it was an agonizing loss, 13-12. I wanted to check on the 42-year-old men and see, does this still sit in your head? Well, in writing the story, I learned there's lots of men walking around the U.S. with, because they wrote to me and told me the stories, you know, this game went wrong when I was in high school. It still bothers me when I'm driving down the road some days, you know. But this story happened to touch on a lot of, you know, the opioid problems, the closing of the coal mines and you know, various issues in this eastern Kentucky town, which I loved. I love Kentucky, and I loved visiting. So, you know, that was another thing that through the lens of football, I got to hear them talk about what their lives were like.
And you talked about lenses. You know, you've grown up in the South. You've worked in Kentucky and other places in the South. You know, I think there is some impression here that we are maybe friendlier than other folks and other parts, at least of the U.S. There's some stereotypes that we like to believe about ourselves and that we also like to believe about other people. As you are a man of the world now, do you see things that are different in the South or maybe things that reinforce or go against what we tend to think about ourselves?
I think I see it pretty much in the same way that the South thinks about itself.
Have you been to another part of the world and you thought this is like the South of X, or, you know, is there like a country that's like feels like the South of Europe or something? You know what I mean?
I don't think anything quite has that, you know, that combination of what would we say? We would say charm. We would say humidity. I always think of humidity. You know, we would say the certain kinds of food, the friendliness factor. You know, I used to walk down the street in Portland, Oregon, when I lived there, and say hello to people, and they didn't do that. You know, and I always felt, you know, kind of flushed, embarrassed. You know, right after saying that, and the friendliness factor and the hospitality factor. Australia could, you know, in just sheer terms of friendliness. And I'll tell you, I've never been there, but I hear this all the time, that Iran is the most hospitable place in the world, and I would love to see it and love to do it. But, you know, just among the people, every single traveler I know, you know, went there from. I have a Danish friend just went there. It's always Iran. Oh, you have to see it, Iran, Iran, Iran. And so, I guess it when you think about that, and then you think about the American South, where I kind of grew up, if Southeastern Virginia counts, sometimes
sure.
It does, and sometimes it doesn't.
Here's my litmus test. If you walked into a diner in Suffolk, would they have sweet tea?
Sure.
Oh, then that's it.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. There's somewhere in Virginia, I think, is the sweet tea line.
Yeah.
You know, you get to some point in Northern Virginia.
Fairfax County.
Maybe, and you get to a place where it's not the default beverage, you know, and somewhere I've always wanted to do like a sociological study. I mean, now you can get sweet tea everywhere. I mean, it's in McDonald's, but there is a place where sort of the hometown restaurant doesn't have it anymore.
Uh-huh.
And that to me is that's like even more important than the Mason-Dixon line. You know, that's the real line.
Right.
So you mentioned a few minutes ago when you were talking about that Mo Salah story about getting into a car with a couple of strangers and riding around their town and getting them to show you. I think that's a thing that a lot of people would not have had the, I don't know if courage is the right word, the boldness to do. What do we not understand about the rest of the world? Those of us who are not either we don't travel as much by circumstance or by choice.
What, you mean Americans?
Yes.
Well, this bothers me probably more than anything, because the things I see and hear here are so mismatched to what's actually out there. 99% of the people plus 99-point-something% of the people are trying to get through the day. That's what it is, and are good, you know. And it's up at about that ratio. And you know, you see those things sometimes where the world is more peaceful than it's ever been. People who've really looked into it, and I could go along with that, even though, because I guess we learn things so immediately, it doesn't seem that way. Within the U.S., falling crime statistics from 1991 to now, you know, and you know, you tell people that sometimes they don't believe it, because we're so inundated with the bad stories that we hear. So I guess, yeah, the thing I would say mostly is, and that really drives me nuts here, is that, you know, people don't understand that 99-point-what percent of the people are trying to get through the day, and they don't understand that they're all mostly very good. And then sometimes the conflation of countries, say, in the Middle East, when I went, I learned that each one of them is different, has a different culture, and they're not all Saudi Arabia. We don't distinguish enough between people abroad and what the different regions mean.
You talked about Iran being so friendly. What's the friendliest place you've been?
The friendliest place I've been. Jordan is very friendly.
Oh, wow.
And very enchanting. India, maybe. Maybe India. But it might have been because of how I looked, you know, because I looked like the exotic, blonde hair.
Right.
And people just came up to me all day long. What are you doing? Where are you from? Would you like to take this tour that I have going on? You know, I was sitting by the promenade near the Indian Ocean one day in Mumbai, and these three schoolboys came up and they sat right next to me. I mean, right next to me in a kind of a less space than we would sit from someone we don't know.
Sure.
And at first I thought, oh, but then I realized, you know, it's so crowded here that it's normal to them, you know. Being there, I've never once again thought of New York is not particularly crowded, you know.
Yeah.
So I think maybe does the crowd level there fuel some type of friendliness? Possibly. But I think that was it. I think just walking down the street every day, 12, 15 conversations, whatever.
When we come back, Chuck Culpepper talks about how hard it was to find a place for him and his partner to live, and how that led him for years to basically live on the road. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Each week on Southbound, we want to take a moment to highlight our listeners. This week, I want to thank a Twitter follower who goes by the handle The Trolley Walk. Here's what The Trolley Walk said about our recent episode with historian Tom Hanchett. The latest WFAE Southbound podcast by Tommy Tomlinson with Tom Hanchett is essential listening to understanding Charlotte's history and the historical mindset of the South. So good. Thank you, Trolley Walk, whoever you are. If you enjoy the podcast, we also want to hear from you. The best way is to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. You can also email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org or tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson. Thanks so much for your support. Now, back to our conversation with Chuck Culpepper. I don't want to ask your favorite sports moments, because that's always tough to put somebody on the spot for anything like that. But if you're, as you just let your mind wander for a minute, two or three events that you've been to, things that felt really meaningful in your life or really special, that you think, boy, I'm lucky to have been there for that.
The 1992 Olympics at Barcelona.
One reason I ask this is because I know you have great recall of many things. And so So the 92 Olympics.
The 1992 Olympics at Barcelona, which were magical from start to finish. I wish I could go back and have it not be my first Olympics, because I felt like I didn't grasp what I was supposed to do entirely, you know. But every day just completely magical in a place, you know, where we used to joke around, maybe they should just have it every time.
Yeah.
Perfect location. The 2008 Wimbledon men's final between Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer that kept getting rain delayed and went on all day.
Right.
You know, won by Nadal, 9-7 in the fifth set. 6-4, 6-4, 6-7, 5, 6-7, 8, 9-7.
I have to tell our listeners that as I was riding up with Chuck today to the studio, he told me the score of a football game from 6 years ago that I attended and covered, and that he did not. And he remembered the score, and I did not. So this thing with the tennis, this is not uncommon.
I'll tell you one. So in Russia last summer at a Colombian match, when they sang the national anthem, and because I'm married to a Colombian citizen, so when I heard them sing the national anthem and knew the history of that country a generation ago versus now, and to find 35,000 of them in a stadium near the Kazakhstan border, that was incredible. Then I'll come back home for one. Clemson, in a sense of watching what they just did in the college football final against Alabama, what I really gather about that is that if you watch that carefully, and what that coach Dabo Sweeney has done, if you watch it carefully, you can gather something about it in your own life. I think I don't know how they've pulled off what they have, how they've reached the level they have, but when you see someone beat Alabama like that and have the confidence to beat Alabama by 4 touchdowns, which is such a rarefied form of confidence, I think that kind of thing often, you know, gets to me. It kind of gets to me like, wow, you know, maybe I should try things more than I try, you know. The Villanova North Carolina Final Four in 2016.
We should mention that the reason you're in town is that you're covering the ACC tournament. And so by the time this airs, that tournament will be over, but the NCAA tournament will be just beginning. And part of the reason you're here is to cover Zion Williamson, the kid from Spartanburg who's at Duke, and I think was 13 for 13 from the floor last night with several dunks.
Yeah.
So when you talk about rooting for the story, is he one of the stories you're rooting for, or do you think about it in a different way?
I think about it differently because he is sort of an emblem of how far athletes have come, that in the sense that 285 pounds can move in that manner. You know, Alabama had a defensive end a few years ago, Jonathan Allen, 290, picked up a fumble and ran it in, and I think it was Mississippi State, and I thought, oh my, people didn't run like that before.
Right.
So this guy, Zion Williamson, is fascinating in that regard to me, because it almost tricks the eye, and it certainly pleases the eye to see the things that he does. But the eye almost cannot believe it. The eye luxuriates in seeing him, you know, even though it's kind of a mismatch against in a lot of situations where that's not particularly interesting. But the eye loves him.
You for the Post cover college football primarily, a lot of college basketball among many other things, and I think many of us are struggling with our love for college sports because it seems to be so clearly corrupt in so many ways, from the players who are not getting paid or getting paid under the table possibly, in a context of coaches and universities raking in legal millions and millions of dollars, to now on the other end, where we kind of found out this week in this college admissions scandal where coaches are taking bribes to basically stash wealthy parents' kids on the end of the Stanford sailing team or whatever. The whole enterprise feels like something that's maybe should be blown up and started over with. But I find myself at the same time in the games, falling in love again and being able to sort of suspend my disbelief at all the stuff that goes on outside the frame. How have you kind of reconciled that, or have you?
Well, it helped me to live abroad for 7 years and to try to explain it to people. You know, when I was in Abu Dhabi, the Penn State scandal erupted, and I had to explain to people they had never heard of Joe Paterno, which was a major, major name in our culture, sports culture, you know. So coming back from that has made me see what extremely rare human behavior this is, practiced by no one else on earth, probably in history, where you have 100,000 people in the stadium to watch college students play, and where, you know, at least with football, the atmosphere is the only thing we have that rivals the noise in European football/soccer. You know, it's the only rival to that within our shores. And it has made me think about it as an exotic thing rather than as the way I thought about it before I lived abroad for 6 or 7 years. You know, it has made me think about it in a way that's fascinating, but I don't love it the same way I did as a child, you know, which was thinking everything so wondrous and true, you know. But
it's true of many things when you become an adult, right? Yeah.
But I think about it as and when I do think about, well, what would we do without it? You know, maybe things would be better without it. I do think of the incredible amount of camaraderie I see on Saturdays. Maybe if I'm at Clemson, maybe if I'm at Tuscaloosa, in the great Madison or Columbus. Of course, you see the great contempt among the rivals too, which is fun because the stadium is probably the best place to have that out. You know,
right.
But there's a community thing going on in so many places with it now, and I feel like on balance, I wouldn't want to lose that. And as for the I don't know what to do about the cheating. I think in some way, I've seen the public kind of soften its mind about that over the last 20 years or so. And I think what might be going on in people's minds is that if a player is being paid under the table, they're kind of happy he's getting something because it balances out the market in a way, even though it's cheating against the rivals and
right.
So on. So I think we're supposed to think that it has been going on for more than a century in that manner. So at some point, some of these scandals that I hear about, I listen to them and everybody's very upset about it, and I'm not as upset because I kind of think, okay, that's a 150-year-old American tradition
right
there. You know, it's naughty, but it's a 150-year-old American tradition.
So when both of us were working for Sports on the Earth back in 2013, you wrote a column that I think the title was something like The Gay Super Bowl,
yeah,
where you basically I don't know if outed is the right word, but you discussed your life as a gay man in sports writing. Obviously, all your friends in the sports writing business knew about this, fellow sports writers.
Sure.
I don't know whether athletes and coaches may have known or whatever, but I think in general, the public, that your readers did not know this information, or maybe a few did. Kind of what led you to that place to decide you wanted to write about it, and was it difficult to... a difficult decision to make.
It's, people always say this, but I'm going to say it too. I wish I'd done it 10 years sooner, 20 years sooner. I think it would have been better for me. The culture in the U.S. changed so much that when I got back and wrote that in 2013, it felt far less risky than it would have felt in 1993, 20 years earlier. I essentially lived one personal life and one work life, and I didn't mingle them the way people usually do, except, you know, friends in sports writing who all knew for a long, long time, and that didn't change. But what was sort of the double life in a way for me was that I was walking to stadiums always feeling scared. The person who spoke and not realizing I was feeling scared because I was so used to it. Well, the person who spoke this the best for me was Ellen DeGeneres, because she said after she came out on that show in the late 90s, she said, they couldn't hurt me anymore, you know. And that's That's true. You have this terrible, in secret to some, not secret to others. You know that people are talking about it and that more people know. People don't tend to ask you about it who don't know you very well. They don't ask you, you know, are you dating anyone or anything like that, which is fine. I always found no problem, you know. A lot of times it's because they're kind and they don't want to say anything that would hurt, you know. So I think what finally led me to do it was I got back to the U.S. after a long stay away, and my buddy Steve Buckley in Boston had done the same 2 years before. And he had written his column in January of 2011. He had immediately gotten this outpouring of support. Bobby Orr, the great hockey player. Bob Kraft, you know, called him that day. So come to see me. I want to just give you my support, shake your hand, check on you, you know, just various people like that. And he had told me that the best thing about doing it is that you hear from somebody out there who's about 17, and maybe it helped them a little bit. And so it was the AFC title game between Baltimore and New England in 28-13 in early 2013. Yeah, and that's when I rode to the game with him and back, and I saw him a lot that week. So it was in Massachusetts. So he.
And there was a player on the Ravens, right?
Right.
I'm gonna have you pronounce it because I'm sure I'm gonna get it wrong.
Yeah, Brendan Iheanacho.
And he had spoken to kind of describe what he had done that led up to that.
He had been this gay rights advocate, you know, as a straight NFL player, and he had a long backstory about why that was true. And I think he has one Nigerian parent, one Irish parent. He's American. He played for UCLA. So after that game, I was down waiting to listen to, I think it was Terrell Suggs of the Ravens, I think. I looked over to the right, and there was Iheanacho.
you too, good.
I looked over to the right, and
there
we're Facebook friends, so I'll just say, I looked over to the right, and there was Brendan at his, at his locker. And so I said, oh, I have to go over there and thank him. So I went over there and thanked him. And then I was spending so much time with Steve Buckley riding back, that I just thought, oh, just go ahead and do this. So it was kind of spur of the moment when I finally did it.
And then what was the result of that? Did you in fact hear from those 17-year-olds that you had?
Yeah. Yeah. Just, I don't think there was any one that could really, that really shone through as different from the others, but that was 6 years ago. And still across the years, you know, every once in a while, there will be somebody who bring it up.
And like Steve Buckley, did you then hear from other players or coaches or anybody like that?
One thing that was different in my situation that made it less courageous than his is that he was and is a fixture in Boston. He had been there decades. He had a column, was on the radio, Red Sox expert extraordinaire, you know, baseball guy. He, you know, because of that reason, there were lots of sources involved that you might have worried about at some point.
Sure.
Players, coaches, whom you knew. I was a nomad, so I would know a coach for a little while in this place, and then I would move to another place for whatever reason, you know, and then know a coach a little while in this place. So it didn't function the same way.
And has there ever been any grief from this or any fallout in a locker room or anything whatsoever like that?
Not a thing. I don't know for sure that there hasn't been some kind of, maybe within the business somebody doesn't want to give you a job, and that would have been years ago. I can't believe the way I live my job now, which is, you know, going to the holiday party like with spouse like everyone else. You know, I never expected that would be a part of my life. You know?
And I guess we should say, I want to kind of loop back in on this. Part of the reason you lived abroad for a while was issues with your partner getting entry into the U.S. Is that right? Am I explaining that right?
Right. We were what was called love exiles, and it was traumatic. It was, you know, it was a crisis.
Your partner's from Columbia, the country. Right. Yeah.
And so,
not South Carolina.
Not Missouri.
Yeah.
So we were trying to figure out, we had to figure out a country to live in the 2000s, mid-2000s. And so you had to find a country where, A, they saw you as a family, which was not true here. We were just friends, according to the law here at that point. B, they would allow people of two different nationalities to live as a family there? Because often in some of these countries, it would be, okay, you know, I'm a national of this country, but the other person isn't. So the government would say, oh, well, good. We'll help you then. You sponsor that person to move in if that's who you want to live with, you know. But we didn't have that option because neither the United States nor Colombia was in that category. So there were only a few choices there. And, you know, we didn't have a country, so we weren't sure what to do. And we applied for a program in the UK, and we eventually moved there. So it was great uncertainty and great distress, great sadness. And then here's the thing. Here's the lesson, if we must have one. That move is the thing that kind of set me off on every single thing that followed in terms of being a real extreme wanderer and jumping off a boat in Cape Town and going to Abu Dhabi, and all of that followed from that move. So what I'm here
to— Do you mean because of— you had job opportunities over there that you didn't have otherwise, or there was something in you that sort of you were able to let go?
Yeah, there was something in me where getting out there and doing that meant, okay, 5 years after that, when I got a call from the Middle East, you know, about that job in Abu Dhabi. Oh yeah, of course. It made kind of a sense of adventure more. It eroded all those fears that I would have had before, which are irrational anyway, because like I said, 99% of the people in the world are really good, you know? So yeah, it set me out on the path that led to all these other things and sort of gave me a better sense of what was possible. So I'm here to say that when the terrible things happen in your life, if you can get through them, wow, you know?
Yeah. And now the two of you are married, living in New York.
In New York, right.
Yeah. And these days, how many days a month are you actually in New York?
I'm there maybe half.
Yeah.
Maybe sometimes
less. There was a period for you that, I don't know if this is literally true, I sort of had the sense that you actually did not have an address. Like if I wanted to mail you something, I wasn't sure where it was going to go. Did you sort of have that life for a while?
I did, from the year 2009 to the year 2017 in April. My name was on no lease, no mortgage. I had a friend, a very dear friend, my friend Amy, a retired food editor, lives in Austin. And I would stay in half of her house sometimes, and I made that a base for a while. But for long stretches, had no base at all. I had a great friend in Queens in New York I'd stay with. But for a long stretch, I had no base at all. It just went on and on and on. And, you know, when you're traveling for work and then you have hotels.
Right.
And then sometimes you patch it together between hotel stays by just paying what you would have paid for part of your rent for another hotel for a week or something.
Right.
And just keep going. And when I lived in the Middle East, I stayed in hotels for almost the entire 2 years there.
Wow.
I found, you know, little residence hotels with reasonable prices. And I was on the road there, too. They would send me out for the sailing race or out to Qatar for the Asian Cup or something like that. And so when I finally did sign a lease again in April of 2017, it was kind of scary. You know? But this is what people do when they're not so abnormal, you know?
Well, I think, you know, if I was a psychologist doing this interview, the obvious question would be, all this time, have you been running towards something or away from something?
I guess away from something. I guess initially I became a wanderer because I was in Kentucky writing a sports column for 9 years, which was both a great time, and I was scared the whole time at the same time. But I guess I just wasn't scared enough to make it terrible, you know, because it was a wonderful experience. Most fantastic boss and newspaper, the Lexington Herald Leader, you know. And so that's when I started on the road. And I think it was to avoid, in some way, being home and being asked the usual questions people are asked when they're at home. Because when you're wandering and you're on the road, you're different. So they want to know about what you've seen lately and what you've been doing and any adventures you've had, not having to deal with yourself so much.
And that's what I guess I don't think we ever really talked about that before, and that your life as a gay man who at least in public was not out,
right,
and your life as a kind of nomad were kind of folded together then.
Yes.
So that was, one was part of the reason for the other.
Absolutely, I think. You know, I had a childhood friend who died, and her two children, now adults, are big wanderers, and their grandmother worries, you know, they travel Vietnam, you know, all over the world. And their grandmother worries, you know, that they're dealing with the death of their mother in that way. And I told her, I said, well, I have to say, out of all the ways, it might be the you know, the best of the lot is to go out and learn and see the world and meet as many of the wonderful people as you can. And so, yeah, I told her, I said, I think that I know what kind of what they're doing because, in a whole different sense, I did it for the same reasons, you know, the same, to flee agony in some way.
So now that that is not so much the case anymore, and you have a place in New York with a rooftop where you can drink coffee and
right,
look out the city.
It's terrible.
When you do that, when you're sipping your coffee, do you feel settled or do you feel restless?
No, we've been talking about, you know, where we would move next. And let's do 2 years here and, you know, 1 year there and 2 years here. I still feel that. And maybe now I'm afraid of that if I, and you know, we travel together a lot,
right,
a lot. So maybe now I'm afraid if I/we lose that. Maybe I fear that in the same way people fear retirement.
Chuck Culpepper is the only sports writer I know who's liked by every other sports writer I know. I think that's because he walks into every new event, every new place, with an open heart. For so long, this country and many others put hurdles in front of Chuck simply because he loved another man from another country. It took his great spirit to overcome that and keep moving. I haven't seen as much of the world as Chuck has, so I tend to believe him when he says 99% of humanity is good. One thing sports teaches us is that the good guys don't always win. But Chuck's a winner. Always has been. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanal. Our web manager is Jessa O'Connor. Our audience engagement manager is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you like to listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.